Hello and welcome to Dynasty as They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host, Kyler K. Jafari.
Hi, hi.
Hi. What's going on in the world this week?
Well, we watched some trash on YouTube about people blowing up a Toontown.
Yeah, the Toontown video. Everybody's seen this already. I think people probably already have their thoughts on it. I just really want to know who the guy in the red backpack is. The guy that
he came, he saw, he went. Vinny Vidi Vici.
Yeah. No, that's the guy that did the sleeper chokehold and he just like vanished. He was like a ninja.
I'm glad you pointed that out. That was one thing I had not noticed. I mean, it is a Where's Waldo painting. I mean, there's so much to observe.
I'm sure a lot of conspiracy theorist podcasts think that he's like an undercover Disney cop or.
Well, there's at least one out there already saying it's fake news. So I don't know. Whatever. This is what you get from postmodernism. There is no reality anymore.
I don't know what to believe, but you know what? You will believe in the Cats trailer.
Yes, get ready for the holidays. You will believe.
What are your thoughts? I know I've made you watch it many times.
My thoughts about this are my thoughts always are about Cats, which is it was this thing that was wildly popular in the 80s when I was growing up, and then it. Very quickly, people began to sort of distance themselves from this. They're like, no, we don't talk about Cats. And Cats became very much sort of like it was put away in the closet for a long time. And I don't know that the world was asking for this. I feel like the people who are in it are asking for it and we're supposed to have a good time along with them. I don't know. But also, I love that Judi Dench is like, well, whatever. I'm not going to be around for too many more years. So let me just do some Cats. And, you know, I forget the character that she's playing in this, but that's the doyen of the Cats, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, of course,
Judi Dench is the only one that has like a cool story because, you know, she was originally supposed to be in Cats, the original production, but she like broke her leg or twisted her ankle or busted a tooth or something.
You know what? It's for the better because we got all those fantastic films that she was in later, and that probably would not have happened.
Oh,
if she had been stuck in Cats in like 1987 or whenever this was going on.
Yeah, I can't remember what cat she was gonna be, but yeah. So that's the only thing that's interesting about this to me. And I don't love Cats, like you're saying. I don't know who actually does love Cats.
It's just one of those. It was just like just so on everybody's, you know, popular consciousness at the time, and then it just went away.
Well, it did something very different than most like Broadway and West End productions did, so I think people credit it for that. But then like nobody actually is like really totally fucking into Cats, are they? I don't know. I'm not.
I just remember drama nerds in high school would have like that poster in their bedroom sometimes, and that was about it. But nobody ever actually talked about Cats.
Yeah, I mean, there's great songs in Cats, and there's great choreography.
There's a couple of great songs.
Well, Memory
and
is
then
iconic.
Some okay songs.
But as a whole package, I don't know if Cats has like the kit and caboodle. Well, what did you think about the actual trailer? Like how the cats look? Because everybody keeps talking
about
that.
Well, I mean, everybody's already had plenty to say about all of that. I don't think I have much more to contribute other than it is kind of creepy AF and a little bit, it's like that Valley of the Uncanny, I guess.
Yeah,
and
that's what everybody's saying.
So I'm just going to be hung up on that the whole time. And also, it had this sort of like Moulin Rouge thing, which I know a lot of people thought that film was like high camp or something, but I think it's a pretty unwatchable film on a level of being good or a level of being bad, it's good. And I think this film kind of has that same issue going on, just based on the trailer. Of course, I haven't seen it, so let me just prejudge all I want here.
Well, yeah, for everything that's wrong with it, and it's funny you bring up Moulin Rouge, I won't tell the story about what happened when we went to go see Moulin Rouge. And you were basically ostracized in the theater for laughing the entire time. But
well, I guess I was the only one who recognized it as high camp in the beginning, but I quickly did not like the film and I don't ever want to watch it again. And now everybody's like discovered it like, oh, remember that bad movie? It's actually really good. And it's like, eh, no, it was bad.
Well, it comes full circle because now, you know, Moulin Rouge is going to Broadway, right?
Yeah, it's like the wheel of sarcasm has come full around and smacked me on the ass.
Yeah, I can't get into any of this. I can't get into the Moulin Rouge Broadway show. I can't get into Cats, the movie. It's like, oh, just come up with something original. I'd I'd watch Dynasty on Broadway, though.
Oh, my God. That would... Well, first of all, it would be a tragedy. You can't do musical with it. I don't... God, could you imagine musical with Dynasty? I don't even see how that would work.
Maybe opera. I don't know.
Okay. I could see a grand opera of Dynasty. Sure.
They actually reference Pavarotti in this week's episode and the opera, so... Yeah. It's all connected. Well, should we just get into this week's episode? I feel like we do have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I liked this episode. Not quite as much as the last one, but I mean, they're really dialing it up this like end of the season.
So. Yeah, you can tell they've definitely found the rhythm.
Yes.
And we are playing.
They have laid the foundation
song
for Miss Joni to come in later, so...
I don't know. We'll talk about that later, but yeah, let's just quit talking about Broadway and start talking about Dynasty, honey.
Yeah, please, come on.
Welcome back. Oh my God, this is the first episode with a murder.
I guess it is. I mean, you've seen everything else, but now we have a murder.
A murder. All right, but let's not start with the murder. Let's start with the necklace.
Am I qualified as manslaughter, though?
So where do we start?
Let's just wrap up all this necklace nonsense.
Yeah, there's necklace stuff, and it really comes to a head finally, and I love how dramatic it was.
Yeah, no, this was a well-done suspense, you know, whereas a lot of times there's like moments of suspense that are not all that suspenseful in this season so far, but this is pretty well done. I mean, the way it's intercut between Linda Evans and you know, John Forsythe and the jeweler, who's this, like, I don't know if he's a character actor or if he just did a one-off here, but he's just, you know, he's got this like amazing look. And
oh yeah, he was cast in this role, and he's like, I am going to steal this little scene.
I want this guy to be my uncle or something, you know, like I need to have him over for cards or something.
Yeah, he was great. So yeah, basically Blake takes Crystal to a jeweler to have the emerald necklace appraised. Totally surprised by this. She was pretty shook, I think. She didn't expect that to happen. And they're sitting there, and she realizes...
Oh, he's a total masochist, because like they pull up in the limo in front of Channing's, which I guess is the jeweler.
Mr. Channing.
And she sees this and she's like, oh shit. You know, this is like when we take our dog to the nail clipping salon, and like he realizes, oh wait, I know where we are. I don't want to go in here.
Right. He's like all excited to go somewhere. And yeah, then it's like, oh,
I'll just stay here in the car. You guys go have fun. And yeah, Blake's like, no, you first, you know. And like he's just like relishing all of the mud that he's dragging her through for this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were playing cat and mouse games in last week's episode. This isn't even like a game. This is just like torture that Blake is administering onto Crystal. And the surprise is it's not a fake. It's the real necklace.
Well, I mean, this is good suspense, because you haven't really, you know, you've been sort of lied to earlier that some man from South America bought it and kissed that necklace goodbye. And here they are appraising what she thinks is the fake necklace. And
right. Just when you think like Blake's depths of depravity can't reach any lower, mm-hmm. he has known about everything that Crystal's done with the necklace the entire time. And set her up.
Yeah, and I think my only real problem with all this is how Blake is like this annoying, like, sky god patriarch, all-knowing, always working in the background.
It's pretty fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like, okay, but it makes for a great scene here, and he's looking at her, and she's looking at the jeweler as he receives the appraisal, and, you know, and we're all just wondering, like, oh, wait till Blake finds out that this necklace is worth, like, $28 or something. And, you know, the jeweler is like, oh, man, you got a good deal on this. This thing's worth $70,000.
Yeah, he paid $60,000, and it's actually worth $70,000. So they're rolling in the dough here. And she sold it off for $40,000. So the math really comes out in Blake's favor.
She's probably kind of pissed about that, too. She's like, God damn it, I could have gotten so much more for this thing. But
yeah, so she realizes that that's the real necklace, and she starts piecing it together. And they go back to the Carrington Mansion, and I love it Blake,
first thing in,
send a couple of glasses to the library, because ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have ourselves a confrontation.
We're
going to
have a showdown hoedown.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the choice of brandy in the day. It's sort of a neutral, you know, it's like, it's not celebratory. You don't drink brandy to celebrate something. You drink it to meditate yourself or medicate yourself. And so, yeah, I think that And they're also, did you notice they're like sitting very confrontationally as well? Like they're blocked like on couches opposite of each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think the brandy was really just lubing them up to completely, it was truth serum, because this is the moment where they're finally being honest with each other. Like the walls are down. Blake says, well, you've learned your lesson. I set this all up. And Crystal,
but again, he's a masochist. He stages this moment in the library with you know, bring the brandy and we're gonna sit like tete-a-tete, like we're in a wrestling match. And he waits for her because he knows like she can't take it anymore and she's gonna eventually have to say something.
Oh no, I don't agree. I think that he thinks that he is the end all be all puppet master, and he says, well, I think you've learned your lesson.
No, he says that after she brings it up. She's like, I know what this is all about. You knew about the necklace all along. Why'd you do this?
No, this really is a moment for Crystal to confront Blake more than she's ever confronted him before, even considering he like raped her a couple of weeks ago. She is taking him to task for orchestrating this crazy scheme
and continuing to try
to take Matthew
Blaisdell
down.
She's on the defense at this point. He's taken her to task and raked her over the coals and all the other things.
No fucking way. She wants to know why he's doing all of this to destroy Matthew Blaisdell.
But he's totally unfazed by this because this is the reaction he wants. He wants to see her agitated and stirred up, and this is a highly negative interaction.
No. She says it herself.
You may think I did something wrong. I don't.
Oh? Perhaps you'd like me to believe that Matthew Blaisdell should be some sort of charity of mine. That he lies somewhere between the Red Cross and Boys Town.
What is this obsession you have with destroying Matthew Blaisdell?
I said that it was over. Let it pass.
It's not over. It won't be over until I sign some kind of affidavit saying I am not sleeping with Matthew behind your back. Until I agree to be locked away in this castle like Rapunzel. Talk to no one, see no one, and only come out when you choose to display me on bank holidays and St. Valentine's Day.
And she's totally standing up for herself. And in a way for Matthew Blaisdell, because a lot of this is just to fuck him over.
Blake doesn't really respond to it to any great degree. I mean, he's not really entertaining anything that she has to say, which is another one of his negotiation tactics.
Oh, he responds to it later. And by responds, I mean downs an entire bottle of scotch in the middle of the night because he can't handle
it. Well, that's for his
it.
Own private issues. That's not something he's expressing to her, and he's not going to give her that power.
Oh, no, I don't think he's expressing that to her, but I think one leads to the other. They have this confrontation, and then he goes off to see Stephen Carrington, but how does he deal with it later? At the bottom of a decanter.
Well, I think this is just, you know, good TV for the times, because I'm sure everybody was at home having the same conversation. Which side are you on, Blake's or Crystal's?
Oh, well, I'm not saying I'm on Blake's side, not at all. He's a villain, and the only way I can watch this show and not want to, like,
no, but there's the thing where, like,
root against
the
him.
Villain is so good and, like, so nasty and bad, like, that you're like, oh, man, this guy's doing it, you know? But I think there's a lot of people who would look at this and be like, no, Crystal's, like, she's got the upper hand. But I don't think she does in this one. I think she's kind of been, not checkmated, but she's been put in a position on the chessboard where she's going to have to start, you know, rearranging some alliances. And that's called out in a moment when the butler comes in after Blake leaves and has this little nasty interaction with her about, you're not welcome here and I am.
Yeah, I mean, to me it's pretty inconsequential because the butler doesn't really hold any power, but he does kind of shade her when she asks him to take the
brandy. That's the power he has, though, because he's a subservient, but he gets to talk that way to her, and she can't really do anything about it, and she's not in a moral position to do anything
about
it.
Well, Joseph gets off on it, but Crystal has bigger fish to fry. I know in the beginning of the season, she was dealing with the household issues, but, like,
Oh no, she's giving up at this point. She don't give a shit about all that stuff.
Yeah,
now.
No, that's petty compared to what she's got going on now.
Yeah, so this, like, you know, Apple Jolly Rancher necklace that got her into so much damn trouble, she's, you know, weeping over it at the desk in the master bedroom later, and we see that Blake's been brought in by the butler.
Yeah, I mean, we knew he had a drinking problem, but it's so bad that he's, like, fucking passed out in the library.
You require servants to get to bed at this point.
Right,
yeah.
And to take his shoes off. Like, that's when you know you're wasted.
That's a little personal to me, but I guess when you have a shit ton of money and you have servants, like, that's just sort of part of the deal, I guess. But, to those of us who didn't grow up that way or don't have that kind of money, it's a little weird that some other dude's taking your shoes off.
Yeah, your major domo is taking off your Louboutins and
Domo
putting them on the floor. And, like, John Forsythe literally doesn't say anything in this scene. Like, he literally is passed.
This
the
was
fuck
a little annoying
out.
To me, and it also kind of went on for a bit too long. I mean, I don't know. You know, Linda Evans is great acting here, and it's very sympathetic, and I almost, you know, cry with her.
But I
it's
think this
kind
of
like,
typifies how much of a monster that Blake is, because she decides, and clearly she had been thinking about this and maybe was going to have this conversation with him when he came to bed sober.
No, that's
why
she's been sitting
conscious
at that desk staring at those damn emeralds that
but
whole
like,
time. She's waiting
she
for Blake.
She has
like,
to leave him, but this is how bad Blake Carrington is, that she has to leave him, basically break up with him while he's unconscious, passed out on bed.
Well, did you see like how he got that way? The I don't know if this was a directorial choice or who decided, but you get this really nice overhead soft focus shot with Blake at the desk with the crystal decanter, and man, he's like hammy drunk acting again, and like the hair's askew, and he's just like, I'm gonna pour me another one, you know. So like, this is like now episode 3, and I think there was an episode a few episodes back. Like, he needs to lay off the brown stuff, because it's doesn't lead to anything good here.
Well, yeah, and even now the servants are talking. We get a scene with two of the maids spilling the tea in the kitchen about how
he's
sauced, and Crystal needs to...
Who's this bottom-feeding bitch that like had her husband come over and pick up the veal that they didn't eat for dinner that night? Like, that's kind of rude.
Well, yeah, and why is she sitting in there eating in her robe if her husband came in
and
picked up
the veal? And poor Jeanette, like, you know, who sticks with the show through it all. Like, she's in the kitchen. She's like, oh, I wanted some of that veal. And other one's like, oh, my husband took it away. But you can have some of this potato soup or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
and Jeanette's
it's
a
delicious
sweetie pie, because she doesn't even drag the other one for eating all
like,
the veal.
I wanted veal, but I'll settle for hot water and shoe leather.
But delish. Yeah, we haven't seen these servants in quite some time, and they have a full-on scene with multiple lines of dialogue.
There's been a fever in this house lately.
Mrs. Carrington is so lovely. I hate to see her trying to cope with his ways.
Well, it seems to me she might try a little harder in exchange for all he gives her.
But really, it's just a vehicle for Joseph to come in and be bitchy again.
Joseph is sort of standing in for what's later going to be the catfights with Linda Evans and Joan Collins. But right now you just get Lee Berger just sort of like chewing on whatever nastiness is in the air that night, which apparently is, you know, my employer, you know, pays your signs your paychecks and you guys better quit gossiping.
Well, and they're all wrong because Blake is a total monster. Like,
well, you know, but when you're talking about the guy who pays you, you kind of overlook some of that stuff.
Yeah, well...
And also, he's in a cat fight with Linda, and he wants Crystal to get the fuck out of the house, so...
But all of that is, like, pretty minor, because Crystal has literally made up the decision in her head that she's gone. Like, she loves Blake, but she doesn't love what he's doing, and she cannot stay in this house. So she gets in a cab, and she pieces the fuck out of there.
Which, to me, this goes into, like, the main theme of this episode, whereas the prior episode is all about like people who don't belong together in partnerships, be it business or cheating or marriage or whatever. This episode's all about unraveling all of these cheater and unnecessary relationships between these people, whoever they might be. In this case, you have Matthew and Crystal, obviously, who are about to separate, or at least ostensibly here in the episode. You have Steven and Claudia, right? They're not going to work out. And Steven and Ted are not going to work out in the worst possible way. You know, the things that have been set up already are now kind of unraveling as far as these like behind-the-scenes affairs that everybody's been having with each other.
Yeah, on her way out of town, she calls Matthew and, you know, he's got his own drama going on, which we'll talk about, but he wants to meet up with her and he wants to make things work. It sounds like he's more invested than ever.
No, but she's like, that would be the wrong thing. And he's like, well, let's do the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. You know? Which like kind of turned me on
a little bit. It's a catchy line. It's hard to say no to that.
You know? And she didn't. They met up and he wanted to go further.
Another one of these like abandoned hillsides outside of Denver. I mean, there's always a place for lovers to meet, I guess.
Yeah, that they love going up to the top of a hill to meet. It seems really inconvenient to me. No, but I like that Crystal has the power to turn Matthew down because she could easily say, I'm done with Blake. I'm choosing Matthew. But that's not what this is about for her. She just doesn't want to be a prisoner in the Carrington mansion. And she doesn't also want to be also ran for Matthew Blaisdell. And he tries to get it. And she's like, no. It might be, I think, because they share a kiss on the top of this hill, and I don't think Bo Hopkins is such a great kisser.
Well, it was classic stage kissing. It's like tight lip, move your faces in a twisty motion. I don't know.
He barely opened his mouth up, and yeah, he just kept turning his head side to side. It very much reeked of like high school drama club acting, but it's like, we're on network television. This is one, you know, a high-rated show.
And this isn't daytime. This is nighttime. Yeah, so this should be a level up.
And the camera's, like, all up in their grills. So, like, kiss for real, damn it.
Maybe Linda had a no-kissing clause in her contract.
Well, she actually seemed like she was, like, doing something, whereas he wasn't.
Well, Linda Evans is clearly the better actor in all of this, but...
Yeah, but I can see why she didn't want anything to do with him because he was not looking like he was really giving her full smooch.
Well, okay, so the other half of Matthew's unraveling of affairs here is with his wife, and you know, she comes to visit at the oil field, and I like that, you know, he kind of does call her out. He's like, "Why'd you come to see me?" Like, you know, and she's like, "Well, we need to go away and renew our marriage, you know, or just sort of like revalidate our commitment to each other." And he's like, "But why? Like, this is so out of the ordinary."
Yeah, she's coming in hot because she just met up with Steven in the park for a really terrible looking sandwich. And Steven reveals that he slept with Ted Denard, his old boyfriend, the night before.
She's like, "Oh shit, I knew it. I knew this was going to happen."
Yeah, she's like, "Oh man, I thought I turned you straight, nope. But you're still not a today, little sister. Gay. So she's quaking in her boots, and what does she do? She runs to the
oil field.
Yeah, she runs into the arms of Matthew Blaisdell, and
is really kind of a sad thing. I mean, this is like, she's been cheating on her husband, but she's clearly, I guess, got feelings for him, but I don't know if that's because they just got married too young and they've just been trying to make it work, and so it's more of a sentimental thing. It's not true love. I don't know. Their marriage is very, you know, screwed up like all marriages on this show. And yeah, here she is. She's just like reaching out to him as one person to another. And he's just like, "But you're not telling me something."
Oh, he knows. He clearly knows, because all she wants to do is run. And she doesn't really explain why. Like, okay, you're having a bad day, but that doesn't mean we're going to move to Sheboygan, Wisconsin, or whatever her plan is. She doesn't really spell it out. She just wants to leave Denver.
Yeah, I got Lancashire Blaisdell Oil Company to run over here, lady.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we've come in, and also we like have a daughter and a house, and like our life is here. So he's like, "No." Also, what the fuck is going on? Explain it to me. And he suspects that she's going a little cuckoo again.
The last time I went through this, it was demons and bats and people listening on your conversations.
I'm not getting sick again. I'm really not. It's not what you have to worry about.
Well, then I have to answer no, because you're not making any sense.
Isn't it enough that I just asked you? I mean, isn't that enough, Matthew?
it's kind of sad because she doesn't get what she wants, which is basically like, can we just like go away together and I can pretend like this affair never happened and we can like try to like heal and make whatever our marriage is work going forward. And he's not against that per se, but he wants to know the real deal and she's not prepared and she just can't because it's going to blow shit up.
Yeah, it's that classic like trying to run away to solve your problems, yeah, which never works.
Which, you know, which Crystal is also doing. She's like just going to go to Ohio. I mean, what is that going to solve? I mean, well, you're still married to Blake, so going to Ohio is going to do exactly what?
Exactly. One thing we didn't talk about is what Fallon is up to this episode.
I mean, no good.
Yeah, after Jeff showing his ass in New Orleans last week, she takes him to task.
Oh, he showed his nipples and thighs and everything else this episode.
A little bit of ball sack at the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, these damn short 80s shorts, man.
Yeah, no, he thinks he's just cute, as they say, and he's just going to lounge by the pool and do whatever the fuck he wants to do.
Maybe go shopping, charge it to the Carringtons.
Yeah, and Fallon is not having it, but kudos to Jeff because he's like, this is what's going to make you riled up. And it works. She's pissed.
He's got her in a stalemate, so she's going to have to make the next move. But until then, there's always lounging by the pool.
Yeah, and he compares himself to a lizard, specifically an iguana from the Galapagos, which, as astute listeners might know, we went to the Galapagos a few weeks ago, so I kind of like cooed when I heard Jeff Colby talking about the Galapagos and iguanas.
Do you think he had been or something, or was this just someplace he'd read about in the National Geographic?
I don't know. Could go either way. But we get our first ever pool shoving moment.
I know. I did like this because, I mean, obviously we're going to get a few of these as the show goes on, but this is
The history of soap operas. I do wonder if this is the first time somebody in a soap has been pushed into a pool. It might be.
I don't know. I think the research department needs to get back to us on that, but it seems like it could have been. I don't recall anything from before, but also my only soap operas from before this that I know are Dark Shadows, which is not the same show. And they don't have pools in Dark Shadows.
No pools in Dark Shadows.
They just have cliffside beaches, which is a different thing to get pushed into. But
the major issue that Fallon is dealing with this episode is car trouble. We've all been there.
Well, I like that the chauffeur like gives her shit. Like Michael's all about some just more undercover misogyny here.
You have no appreciation. A car like that cost upwards of $80,000 and you treat it like a pickup truck. But it's something very, very special. And to be handled special. Like a woman.
I wouldn't know about that.
Yeah, Michael's doing that same damn thing where he's like trying to like make
Fallon he's pissed because she won't ride the hobby horse anymore. I mean, that's his problem, right?
Yeah, but she goes back and forth. So his dick is always a twitter when she walks around because he doesn't know what mood she's going to be in. Maybe she wants to climb aboard his shifter, but today she ain't in the mood.
No, she puts that shit in reverse. And, you know, I got to tell you, this is more character analysis. She knows how to reverse like a motherfucker.
Like,
I have never seen somebody reverse a car so quickly around a twisty driveway like that.
This
I thought
was
they
like
shot
some
it.
Steve McQueen Fast and Furious realness. She peels out of there in reverse away from Michael the chauffeur in a way that no daredevil
she don't
driver.
Fishtail. There's no understeer oversteer. I mean, that was just course corrected like a surgeon. I had never seen somebody do that. I don't even know if I'm capable of that.
Yeah, and I've seen you go backwards up and down the Beverly Center parking garage for three levels.
Yeah, well, tell that to all the other people there that saw it too. But
the other person running away, I guess, toward their problems, not from them, is Ted Dinard, Stephen Carrington's lover. So they hooked up. Ted's back in the picture, and he's wanting to move in and be with Stephen and ready to just get back to the way things were. But he's got a big problem, or actually a little problem, because he's so much shorter than he is, in Blake Carrington, who pops over to Stephen Carrington's new apartment and finds Ted shirtless right out of the shower.
Fresh out of the shower.
Ted is like, ruh-roh. He did not expect to meet Blake Carrington in this way. And he comes up with this kind of like cockamamie story that he...
This is why I don't answer the door if I'm not expecting somebody. I just pretend I'm not home.
Why? Because Blake Carrington might be at the door?
It's possible, you know. I mean, one time it was a Jehovah's Witness, and it's like, oh, I know how to deal with you people, but you just don't know.
Yeah, I'd much rather have a Jehovah's Witness than Blake Carrington, because he gives Ted Dennard the full court press on, like, who the president of Princeton was. Because Ted is, like, trying to fool Blake into just thinking, oh, I'm just over here as one of Stephen Carrington's college buddies, but... Blake Carrington has been around the block and also the battalion, because we learn he's a vet and he was at D-Day, which is like interesting insight.
Well, no, I think a lot of men of his age at that time were. I know my grandfather was. I think that was nothing to be, you know, treated casually, but I mean, that certainly would have been a thing.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I usually support the troops, but when it comes to Blake Carrington, I wish he probably would have died in the war because he's such a terrible person. But yeah,
at least he didn't claim bone spurs.
Yeah, I guess he did serve the country, but he sees right through Ted Dennard's facade.
He sees through his chest hair, too, which is a little upsetting in some ways. But I think that I'm very confused about what Ted is supposed to be here, because did he really go to Princeton?
No, he said in the last episode he went to... Loyola Marymount lesser school.
Oprah School of Business and Spiritual Relations.
Phoenix University.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
So, yeah. So, like, I guess he's just sort of trying, but he already knows he's trapped. He's like, damn, like, I can't play with Blake because Blake's already two steps ahead of me on this conversation. And I guess he's saved by Steven coming in the room, because then he doesn't have to, like, continue this awkward conversation where he doesn't know anything about Princeton and Blake wants to sort of like dig into that, you know?
Yeah. And Steven has the same kind of reaction. He's like, oh no, Dad is here. He sees my gay life right in front of him. And as I think a lot of people back in that time had to do, they keep wearing these masks.
Oh, he's my roommate.
Like, this is going
on. He's my friend.
Oh yeah. I'm sure you and your friend are going to go out with your other friends tonight.
Are you going down to the glory hall? Tell him I said hi.
It's super awkward, but you know, Blake keeps his facade up and just says, nice apartment you have here, see you later at the house where Stephen Carrington is going to pack up the rest of his belongings and establishes independence.
Well, basically this leads to the sort of the dissolution of the relationship between Stephen and Ted, and Stephen's already sort of like had this disillusion with Claudia, which then leads to this, you know, triangulation of Ted and Claudia later, which is sort of an interesting turn, I guess. I mean, the lovers meet, you know, the forlorn lovers, I guess. I feel like Steven's just not really taking any responsibility in any of this, and it's a little bit irritating on this character's part.
Yeah, I mean,
I think he's a little bit underdeveloped in that way.
Yeah, the episode was hard for me to watch because I don't really know what Steven is thinking, because it seems like
Steven knows what he's thinking.
Yeah, maybe that's the point, but it doesn't seem like he's really into Ted, and it seems like he's waning on Claudia, especially considering she's married. So I don't really know what Steven wants, but the craziest thing is, like, Ted and Claudia both really, really want Steven. And, like, Al Corley's cute and all, but I can't imagine,
he's just, like, upending
your
attractive
life in New York, yeah, or upending your marriage to be with this, like, you know, blonde 25-year-old twink.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, he is rich, so there's that.
He's sort of a lost 24-year-old. I really don't understand what these two see in him.
Yeah.
But.
And so the craziest thing happens is that Ted goes to the bookstore and meets up with Claudia, who apparently knows who Ted is because she saw a picture in the nightstand.
That's got to be every like cheater's worst nightmare, that like the people they're cheating around with like meet up independently and like start talking about them.
I think it's totally fine in this case because they're all fucking keeping secrets from each other. Claudia's keeping secrets because she's married to another man, and Ted's keeping secrets because he's, you know, a gay man living in the closet. And so it's actually really interesting that they go into the back of the bookstore behind closed doors.
We gotta keep the stuff in the stock room.
Yeah, but I love that all of their walls come down and they're completely honest with each other, which kind of made me realize, like, okay, this is why Steven is into both of them, is because they're both really open souls with their emotions and feelings.
They're open souls, but they're broken people. I don't know. There's a lot of dysfunction in all of these people's personalities.
Both of these people feel like they're in a competition with each other. Tad even tells Claudia, like, just give him up. But the funny thing is Stephen doesn't really want either one of them, which we see later when he breaks it off with Ted.
Is just like dreadful bisexual melodrama. It's the old, there's like all these like European art films that always like liked to go down this road. I don't know. It's interesting how it shows up here in like a nighttime soap opera.
Well, yeah. And I think it's not really about choosing between one gender or the other. It's between choosing these people. And Stephen doesn't want either one of them, it seems like. And
I think Claudia is an interesting character and I love her a lot, but I don't think the two of them make any sense together. They kind of did in the beginning, but that was more for story device, right? But here it's just like, no, they emotionally really are oil and water. And like the Ted thing doesn't even really, he just seems like a stand-in for something.
Well, speaking of story device, Steven breaks up with Ted through a note that's left in the apartment, because Steven's back at the Carrington Mansion packing up the rest of his belongings. And I don't know. I don't feel like Steven's the kind of guy who would break up with somebody through a note. Like, that's very
I struggled with that. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I thought that was indicative of the character or not. I do think there's parts of Steven that are not able to be confrontational. And so, you know, obviously that's why you write a letter and not just say it to their face.
I think it was more about getting Ted to the Carrington Mansion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was like cheesy Edgar Allan Poe writing in that sense. Like, this is like, how do we just introduce an element that escalates the character to another situation? And here you go. He's there in Stephen's bedroom at the Carrington Mansion. And it doesn't end well.
Yeah, that's the understatement of the podcast. Ted is in tears at the Carrington Mansion, begging for Steven to keep him. And I've been a little bit on the fence about this stalkery personality trait of Ted's, but for sure, he's like super desperate now.
Oh, yeah, he's like beyond thirsty. At this point, he's just gonna give it all up for whoever, and Steven's not there for it. I do like that Steven just sort of says, if you love me the way that I loved you, which that's all like past tense, right? So clearly Steven's already moved on. Just a little bit. It's kind of cold, but also Ted's kind of annoying. So it doesn't bother me that much.
Well, then the wildest thing that's happened in the whole course of this entire show happens. Blake Carrington comes home ostensibly from work because he kind of like passes off his briefcase to a servant, and he hears that Ted Denard is upstairs with Mr. Carrington.
Well, again, it's these gossipy servants. I mean, I get it. Like, they're his information network, but it's like, man, they just love dishing up the details.
Oh, yeah, they live to spill the tea.
And I think that I like that, you know, the butler is like, well, and Steven's upstairs with a friend, a Mr. Ted Denard, and he's like kind of just sort of like enjoying this little detail that he knows, but like he doesn't realize that this is really going to set some shit off. And Blake just like says, I'm going to kill him.
Like, he goes into a rage, and he's not even drunk, which is why I explained that he's coming home from work.
Maybe like, he needs to be drunk because he wouldn't get in this rage. I don't know, because like, yeah, this was very intentional, and it's a little bit heavy-handed the way it's directed.
Yeah, the directorial choices here are bonkers. We have a POV shot of Blake trouncing.
Oh, it's like angry
up.
Blake Cam, like with it's kind of like that moment from Bram Stoker's Dracula where he turns into a werewolf and like you get that fast POV up the stairs into her bedroom. It's the same kind of like idea, like with the shaky cam and like it's implying all the mental instability that's
yeah,
like
and
about
Blake's
to proceed
perfectly
this decision.
Coiffed hair instantly goes haywire. It's all over the place and he's just shaking around as he goes into the room and sees Steven and Ted kind of embracing.
They're saying goodbye.
Yeah, they've come to an understanding. Ted has kind of chilled a bit.
It's that like classic unfortunate irony, you know, where like he opens the door and he just sees them like he just thinks
two
they're like
men
making out.
Hugging
yeah.
These homosexuals in my home.
Shoot them up.
How dare you bring that depravity into the Carrington mansion?
Get your hands off my son.
Dad, we were.
I said, get your hands off it.
And I don't know what his intention is, but he's just like pulling Ted off of Steven. And then Steven's like trying to pull Blake.
Oh, he's
going to
beat his
Ted.
Ass. Yeah.
But like, what's the point? Just like say, stop doing that. Get out of here. But it becomes overly physical. Like we've never seen Blake get this physical unless he was like on the back of a horse.
I was just expecting like a Derringer snub nose or something, you know, like
I take that back. We saw him get physical on top of his wife when he raped her.
Well, I guess you're right. Yeah. So maybe he is a man of physical action at times. I really thought he was just going to do it gun style, but you know, here it is. He's mano a mano.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately we have little John Forsythe and the guy that plays Ted Dinard is towering over him, but it doesn't fucking matter because he pushes him, trips over one of Steven boxes, and then blam kablooey, John Forsythe pushes Ted Dinard into the damn fireplace, knocks him cold. And by cold, I mean dead.
Yeah, it's on this like fire coal and iron thing. I mean, like, whoever knew that would ever kill somebody. But anyway, and then you get these like bad, like sad eye, like the big eye pictures from Fallon. And
right, Fallon and Steven walks in because she hears this tussle, and Pamela Sue Barton is just giving reaction.
Well, and again, you're being set up because like Blake already said in front of everybody and God, like, I'm gonna kill him. And then like here's Fallon watching it all happen. So you've got all the like bits and pieces you need for your murder mystery at the court trial that's probably about to happen. And Steven is like, you've killed him. He's dead. You know?
It's yeah.
Like,
if you didn't think so he was dead, then you do have Steven say, he's dead. Nobody's calling for 911 or anything. This is not a way to handle an emergency.
Because well, these are rich folks and they have their own rules. And they're like, well, how can we just kind of like tidily clean this up and not have this in the papers tomorrow morning?
But yeah, I don't know who to blame in this whole altercation. Obviously, Blake is way more unhinged than he needs to be. But also, Steven shouldn't have left that box out because that box is really what did Ted in, because he tripped over that and that's what forced him to hit his head on the fireplace.
It wasn't Blake pushing him across the room that did that?
It was, but I don't think he would have hit the fireplace had the box not
been
there.
Want you on my jury. Next.
Well, let's talk about our looks of the week. I don't know about you, but you know what look I was loving? Mr. Channing the Appraiser.
Really?
Yes. He had that bow tie with that little square pattern. And then he had his monocle that he was using.
I think this is a cop out. I mean,
I'm not going to apologize. I thought Mr. Channing was serving men's wear realness. I don't think a lot of the women's looks were up to snuff. There were some nice dresses here and there, but for the most part, nobody was wowing me. When Mr. Channing came on the screen, and yes, admittedly, the actor was giving the performance of his life, I was eating it up. What did you like? What was your look of the week?
Well, he was definitely sharp, and he looked like a character as much as he was acting like a character. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate your perspective on that one. I mean, look, Blake's suits are certainly not very interesting in this episode or really any episode. But as far as the ladies go, I'm really into Fallon's look poolside in the beginning. It's a little bit obvious, but I mean, it's like head to toe red. And here you have another one of your classic jumpsuits in a blousey material, you know, so it's like, how many of these have you ever found at the thrift store? Well, maybe not now, but, you know, back in the day. But, you know, this was, everybody had this jumpsuit, but she's doing it. And I like the high collar on it, which is a new way to do it, because before it's usually like low cut.
Yeah.
And I like that it's paired with the red pumps that have the open toe and the white edging on them. So it's just a little bit of white against everything else that's red. And the worst part about it is she gets pushed in the pool wearing it.
I was going to say, my favorite part about this outfit is the fact that she swam in it. Because, I don't know, it's another
jumpsuit. That's
quite
a swimsuit, lady.
It's another jumpsuit from Fallon. And, I don't know, I'm a little bored by her jumpsuits. And this one wasn't taking the cake for me. Well, Kyler, thank you so much for joining me again on another episode of Dynasty as They Wanna Be.
Man, this is always so much fun.
It's so much fun. This is becoming the highlight of my week, talking about Dynasty. And like we were saying at the beginning of the episode, they're hitting a stride here. And I think they've really found the tone. And I can see like why they're going to go in the directions they're going to go.
Man, just you wait.
I'm waiting. And I can't wait. I mean, I guess I can because I just said I'm waiting. But we're headed into the home run of the first season. And I can't wait to see what happens with this murder and with the Carringtons and the Colbys and the Blaze. Okay.
I can't wait for the spinoff when Crystal's like living in Ohio.
Yeah, we know that's not going to stick. But thank you so much for joining me. And I want to thank the listeners. Thank you so much for listening. If you've been listening every week and you're into this journey that we're going on watching Dynasty together, leave a review. Tell your friends. We could use some support or just like more people listening because we want to have fun. You guys are starting to kind of like tweet with us and get with us on social media. And we want to keep that going because we are having a blast.
Kaboom.
Anyway, that's it for this week's episode. You guys, please be careful around any boxes on the floor. That's what this episode really taught us.
And watch out for fireplace hardware.